Good afternoon, I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. Personally, I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics, like mercury, PFAS, pesticides, are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is Mindy Messmer. She's a scientist with a master's degree and career in clinical and translational research, who became involved as a local activist in a town experiencing a tragic cancer cluster. She was elected to the New Hampshire House of Representatives and now is the author of Female Disruptors, Stories of Mighty Female Scientists. I'm delighted to have you on What Mama Wants today, Mindy.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Your book, you know, Female Disruptors, has so much feminist information in it. And it just made me think about that feminist theory that states the personal is political. And that seems especially true for you and your story. I wondered if you could explain how you got involved in the community and state politics when you were already busy as a scientist, a wife, a mother, and what that problem was in your hometown.
Sure. I was minding my own business for a long time, bringing up my two sons and working as a scientist. I felt like it was important for me to continue being a scientist, to model to them how women could do everything and not have to give that up. But in 2014, I started getting some calls from moms in my town expressing concerns about these kids that were having these rare cancers that my youngest son was going to school with at the elementary school at the time. And it was concerning. They said, "You're an environmental scientist. Doesn't this sound like it's a problem?" And sure enough, I knew it was a problem just because we don't expect to see a lot of rare cancers in children, the same kind, in a small town like ours. So I knew it was a problem. I reported it to the state. 2 years later, the state said, "You're right. It's a pediatric cancer cluster, these actually double cancer cluster of two different kinds of rare devastating cancers were affecting the children in my town and several of the kids that my sons both knew." So it was very upsetting as a mom. And I realized that I had to stop just looking at data and I had to get away from that computer and start really thinking about what was going on in my own community. It was very devastating to see what those families are going through. And still today, you know, there's concern. So I was asked to run for office, as most women do. I would never have thought to do it myself, not even for a minute. And the first thing I said to him was, "Are you crazy? I'm not a politician. I'm a scientist. I don't even know what it's like. I would never. I'm just a person sitting on your computer every day. I don't have that kind of skill set." He's like, "That's why we need you. We need scientists writing policy." So he was right. A couple of days later, I decided to run for office. I won. I went to the New Hampshire State House with a mission to improve the health of the community in which I lived and across the state.
So you were living in Rye. Mm-hmm. Was the cancer cluster in Rye or in the region generally?
Yeah, well, I know of myself at least 5 cases of these rare cancers in children in my town alone. When the report came out, it covered 5 seacoast towns, so mine plus 4 other towns. So there were other cases that I wasn't aware of at the time in those other towns. And when I delved a little bit further back in history, I also found many other cases of these rare cancers prior to the time frame that the state had issued the report for. So yeah, I wasn't aware of those other cases at the time, but I was aware of the ones in my town. So it covers 5 town area.
And did they ever figure out to your satisfaction what the cause of the cancers were?
No, I mean, realistically, when you have a small number of rare cancers, you just are not going to find the smoking gun. Because it's so hard to tie A to B, to say this is causing this. So what I like to do is instead turn around that paradigm on itself and say, well, we know these certain things that we're being exposed to aren't good for you. So let's remove those. Mm-hmm. Let's find out what is a problem, what we know or what we're learning to now know. Back then, we didn't really know about PFAS, these perfluorochemicals that are the Teflon-like components. Come to find out they're rampant in seacoast area water systems and have been for decades, but we didn't know about that. So let's think about the ways to remove environmental exposures to stop that overflowing teacup of environmental exposure chemicals, you know, that we're always exposed to and see if we can reduce the rates.
Yeah. And so that's what you all set out to do.
Yeah. That's correct. Yeah.
Your newly released book, Female Disruptors, examines topics that are not really commonly taken together, such as toxics, politics, science, and feminism. I love it. And you've done that in a way that is truly unique and insightful and really enlightening. In writing this book, I'm wondering what you ended up learning about women in science that you didn't know and why that matters so much.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I was sort of a scientist sitting behind my computer. I had thought, you know, we had come pretty far in terms of accepting women as scientists, listening to them and valuing their opinions as much as our male counterparts. But when I went into this, it was a very challenging issue. So what happened first was that the state didn't talk about the report in the public. I blew the whistle on it. It was reported in the media because they were not going to say anything about it. And people in my town and other towns were very upset about that. And I don't blame them. So it became very much an emotional issue. And when you're thrust into the middle of an emotional issue like that, they start hitting the messenger. And I don't mean the people for the most part. It's not the people, but it's the regulators of the people in charge of protecting the public. And the way that my experience was when I was thrown into that situation was kind of eye-opening to me. I thought we had come a long way. I thought I wasn't going to be called a baby in a public meeting, which I was. You have to not act like a child and wait. You know, that kind of stuff, talking about me as a child, was just because I never really speak in those real emotional terms. And I'm not crying in public. You know, I'm talking about data and science and trying to be logical about things. And it was really a disturbing thing to me to see how I was treated by so many people. So I wanted to say, you know, have we really come as far as we thought we had come in history? So I wanted to look back and say, this is what happened historically to all these women who are scientists. This is what's happening currently to other scientists, including myself. I talked about some of my experiences myself, but it was really interesting, especially with COVID, the pandemic. So many women scientists were out there on Twitter and getting attacked day after day after day. And the way they were treated was very different from the way the men were treated, the scientists speaking out. So I thought it was really an interesting thing to look at. I hoped we had come further than we have. And I just know that as we face all these issues that we now face, we face climate change, we want to protect our drinking water because it's going to be less and less of it as we experience more frequent droughts, as the storms we get are more severe, spreading chemicals and things into our drinking water aquifers. All of these challenges are so complex, and we can't afford to keep 51% of the public out of this conversation by not appreciating what women have to contribute to that. And, you know, I think women have a different perspective too. Like me, I fight because I see those moms and those other families and what they experience. I see as if they're my kids. And I think a lot of women are the same way. And they really take that on as a fight in a different way than men. I'm not saying men don't, they do. But I think women are just different in how they approach things.
Your COVID reality was grueling. I wondered if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, we had just come back from a family trip and we were standing in the airport in a foreign country going, oh my gosh, I hope we make it home because this COVID thing seems like it's really exploding. It did. As soon as we got home, COVID started. And immediately as we got back from this trip, my husband started to appear to be getting sick and we didn't understand why. We thought he had COVID. One night he got very ill and had to take him in the middle of the night to the hospital. It turns out he had acute myeloid leukemia diagnosis, which if you know, that's a diagnosis related to exposure to toxins. So kind of ironic that someone like me who's fought to prevent cancer, to prevent toxin exposures, would have that come so close to my own home. This happened right when he was taken by ambulance down to the hospital in Boston under lockdown for 6 weeks in Massachusetts in a hospital in Boston. So I didn't know what was going to happen to him. Right at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, we had to protect ourselves. My son and I stayed in our home. We really wanted to make sure that if he could come home, it would be to a safe environment. So we were very careful, not knowing what was going on at the beginning of the pandemic. So the nurses in the hospitals really sacrificed a lot of their own personal time. They didn't do anything either. The only time they socialized was among themselves. They were very careful about making sure they wouldn't make the patient sick. So there's a whole world out there of people who, when something like a pandemic happens, are very vulnerable. Those are the most vulnerable people. It can be kidney disease, it can be cancer. And so it impacted me personally directly. I was very upset by people who didn't want to wear masks and things like that. But so I think it's important to prevent toxic exposures so that we prevent cancer and keep people as healthy as we possibly can. So in the event of a pandemic again, they're not going to be vulnerable to the effects of those pandemic viruses.
Yeah, when a population is healthy together, you can avert a lot of awful risks.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
Your book's incredibly relevant because it came out in 2022. You talk a lot about COVID and the kind of catastrophic hit it took on women's progress, especially in the science fields. There were so many things I just never thought of in the book. For instance, if you need to work part-time because you're caring for your children at home, you don't get to run the lab, which means you don't make full professor, which means the departments stay predominantly male for generations to come.
Absolutely. And that's part of, you know, we're not making the progress we need to make. I got to speak to some amazing women like Linda Birnbaum, the former head of the NIEH, and she works with me on various issues. Still, she's an amazing woman. She had some very valuable perspectives on job sharing. You know, a setback of 5 years shouldn't set back your career for life. You know, if you have to stay with your kids for the first 5 years of their life, you should be able to do that and not be able to suffer the consequences. And that feeds into how women are treated, younger women are treated. You know, they're not valued as much because they're looked at still, even though nobody says it. You know, they're going to be of childbearing age. So what are they going to be able to contribute? You know, they're devalued when they're compared to their male counterparts.
Yeah, I really appreciated that you took on some of the unspoken things that we just take for granted. And there were a couple things that you talk about in your book that I wondered if you could just highlight the concept of. One is the Matilda effect. I thought that was so interesting and really roped me in early in the book.
Yeah, that's kind of along the same lines as women being underrecognized, right, for their contributions. There was a great book by Rossiter about all of these female scientists. There's so many, unfortunately, that I started to create a database of my own to say, you know, these are the women that are underrecognized. And it's just a huge effort to undertake, unfortunately. And she did a really good job. I think it was 3 volumes that really documented a lot of these things. When I look at things like Nobel Prize winners, almost all of them are men. There's hardly any women. I'm thankful that in the past week we heard of another woman who won the prize for chemistry, which was fantastic. But that should be much more normal than it is, normalized than it is, right? And even like my book, I was at a book club meeting and somebody said, how come your book has so many references in it? No, I hadn't thought of it before. And a friend of mine who's there said, because she's a woman and she has to reference all the things she talks about because nobody's going to believe her if she doesn't. But it was interesting to hear that, you know, question come up and then hear the perspective from somebody else on the outside observing it. So, but, you know, as I started saying, as a politician, you know, I think women generally don't feel like they're qualified, whereas men will just be like, oh, I'm going to run because I should. Right. And women almost always need to be asked to run for office. But let me tell you, the viewpoint of women in political office, writing policy, being involved in getting negotiated policy happen, especially now with what's happening on a national level and in all of our states, with women's access to healthcare and things like that, is so critical. So as much as in the book, I detail a lot of the things that were so upsetting to me, like people criticizing me for my hair when they didn't even listen to what I was saying, it is so critical now for women who are becoming scientists, who are getting involved in science, to express their opinions, to be involved in supporting policy measures that will help all of us right now as we look to the challenges of the future.
Yeah, it's probably our best hope at parity in healthcare and getting a decent childcare across the country and things like that, more women in office.
Absolutely.
In your book, you talk a lot about the control chemical companies and manufacturers have over our regulatory agencies like the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and the Environmental Protection Agency. right now. And I wonder how this corruption that you note, how does it impact us in regard to toxic exposure?
I've got a great case study for this from my own personal experience. So when I was elected, I put four bills in the first year I was there. The first one of those four was to regulate these toxic forever chemicals in the drinking water in New Hampshire. I faced a lot of pushback on that. It failed the first time. The second year, though, we got it through. The day that that bill went into effect, 3M, one of the manufacturers of the chemicals, came in and they blocked implementation of our law in the courts. And they held up that implementation for over a year. Luckily, we had another legislator who took it on and wrote the standards directly into our law. So they circumvented the court system. And thankfully they did, because we'd probably still be arguing about it right now in court. So that's a perfect example. All the science was there. I got it all through the legislature, a Republican-controlled legislature. It isn't really that easy as a Democrat to do something like that, but we finally got it through. We got it passed. The governor signed it. It went into effect, and the day it went into effect, 3M came in and blocked it in the court system. So all the science was there to support it. The facts that people are being exposed in New Hampshire, the facts that the, you know, all of the science was supporting how low those standards should be, yet they were able to do that. And they have a lot of money. And so we aren't the only state that they did it in. They did it to New Jersey. They've done it step by step in all these different states as they implement drinking water protections against their chemicals. That's a perfect example of the power of these multi-million, billion-dollar companies and the power they wield in fighting against us as we're trying to protect public health.
Yeah, it's so concerning when the people ask for it, they jointly, both sides of the aisle, decide it's important. And then the chemical company says, wait a minute, I thought I was going to make more money here.
Exactly. It's all about the big, mighty dollar. And it's on the state levels. It's in the federal system. It's in the federal EPA. It's in the federal FDA. There was a series of stories by a wonderful investigative reporter, Sharon Lerner, who went and looked specifically at what's going on in EPA. There were some whistleblowers that came out that she highlighted in her stories from EPA. These people that were the toxicologists, the scientists who were responsible for approving new chemicals, they were pressured by their management because the industry was coming in to meet with their managers, or maybe the managers were actually from the chemical companies. They were pressuring these scientists to sort of look the other way in many cases. And those scientists, I think it's six or seven of the seven that were responsible in this, in one part of the EPA, came out and blew the whistle on what was going on. And that's very important for us to hear from these people, these whistleblowers inside these agencies, about what's really happening. The people that really care about what's happening and what that impact will be on all of us is so critical.
Yes, absolutely. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Mindy Messmer, a scientist, former New Hampshire representative, and now author of a brand new book, Beckoning Women into the Sciences. It's called Female Disruptors, Stories of Mighty Female Scientists. Could you help us connect the dots and highlight some of the solutions that you point to in your book regarding this complicated soup of toxics, corruption, climate change, and social justice?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've really enjoyed over the past few years is going to speak to students, because I don't want them to get disappointed. I don't want them to feel like they shouldn't do some of these things. And I often find that they ask some of the best questions. One of the more recent conversations I had at one university in New England was when a student asked me, so I'm a scientist about to enter this field on the industry side. What can I do to make a difference here? And I said to them, well, you know, we can change the way we think about these things. We can make change in terms of how do we approve these chemicals for use on the market. We need to have those studies before we put them onto the market, rather than after the fact finding out that we've been sort of the guinea pigs for the chemical industry once we've been exposed to them for decades. We can also look at ways to improve our assessment of whether or not these are actually essential chemicals. With PFAS chemicals, from cradle to grave, from the very beginning of how we make these chemicals to the very end, how do we assess the cost and whether we balance out the benefit versus the cost of these chemicals? The forever chemicals we're finding are there forever, and they're contributing to climate change in a big way themselves with air emissions of these PFAS chemicals to the atmosphere. And what is that going to do long term? They're forever. So is it really necessary for us to have that extra waterproofing on our raincoat, on our socks or shoes or whatever, or your pants that you wear, at the expense of having these chemicals with us forever? We look at things like radioactive energy production. What's the cost from the very beginning of mining those uranium-rich chemicals to be into the nuclear system versus when they're around forever too? So that's the kind of thing. Start thinking about the long-term effects. Start thinking about really looking at whether we need to have these things or if they're just nice things to have at the expense of a long-term problem. And starting to look at how these things are impacting communities, like I said in the beginning, but start checking off the list, the things that we know or suspect already. Instead of erring on the side of the chemicals, having to prove they're bad for us, let's just start turning it around, the paradigm around, and saying, we don't think these are good for us. So let's get them out of our systems and out of our exposure teacup that we're exposed to every day.
Yeah, think of them as guilty until proven innocent rather than the other way around, which the cost is so great. You know, so many families who've lost children to cancer unnecessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's so heartbreaking. And I go quickly from sad to really mad about that gross negligence. Where's the protection?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what do you think Mother Earth wants? This one's wide open for dreaming. You've worked with toxics. You've worked with policy. You work with science. You work with women. What does Mama want?
I think Mama wants us to be more forward-looking in general. I think that we face some incredible challenges that aren't insurmountable, though. But we just have to make the changes we have to make. We have to just say, enough of this fossil fuel production. We have to get over it. We have to encourage people, use sustainable energy sources. We're in New Hampshire. I live in New Hampshire. We can't even buy a plug-in electric vehicle in New Hampshire from a dealership because of the laws surrounding this issue. So we have to get over this. We have to make it much more accessible. We have to promote it. We have to provide, you know, benefit to the manufacturers who engage in this sort of production. We all have to start thinking ahead rather than preserving our pocketbook today. What's going to happen with our children in the future? I think that's what Mother Earth wants. And that goes with fossil fuel production and use of fuels, but it's also chemicals. It's looking ahead to how we treat women and families and the health of those families into the future, not just today. We have to think about the future more.
Yeah. Well, you really make the point in your book about empathy. And then here you're saying, you know, look out for Mama. What do we want for ourselves? To close this interview, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions about your relationship to the earth, if you're game.
Sure.
As a kid, what was your favorite thing to do outside in nature?
This is so easy. So I was a geologist, but I was a geologist from a very young age. So my favorite thing to do was to pick up rocks on every single family vacation. One particular, I do say this in my book, but when I went away for a summertime to do a geologic field camp for the summer out west, I came back with my frame pack emptied of like any other contents except from the rocks I'd picked up along the way. It was very heavy. But when I got to the airport and my father picked me up, he tried to pick it up and he said, "What, do you have rocks in this bag?" And it was filled with rocks. So
really cool.
My favorite
ones.
Thing. Yeah. My favorite thing to do was to pick up rocks. And I had the best collection of rocks in my fifth grade science project.
Were you raised in New Hampshire?
No, I was raised in upstate New York, actually.
Because New Hampshire has some pretty great rocks.
We do. And beach walks with rocks every time I go to the beach, just about I pick up a cool rock still.
Mm-hmm. Describe a scene in nature when you have felt awe.
We took a family trip to Hawaii a while ago, and it is just amazing to see the relationship between the fauna and the water systems. It is really a culture there of sustainability, and that's a perfect example of what we should replicate all over the United States, how they're very in tune with, you know, protecting nature, protecting the environment. The waterfalls are just amazing there.
That's interesting, that island mindset. We could really take that and run with it.
Yes.
That's a cool idea. What's one thing that you tend to wonder about in nature? Why is this way? Or why do these little things do this?
Oh my gosh, there's a million of them probably. I think, you know, I like to garden a lot and I like to see the way things grow and I like to watch how different things respond. You know, like this summer, my basil didn't do very well, but my rosemary did well. Different plants survive better in different environments. And I like to see how certain flowering plants did better, certain other ones didn't. So adaptations to the environment is really important to me to watch.
That's pretty scientific.
Yeah, I know.
Last question. What is your favorite baby animal?
Oh, cats, I'd have to say. We have a great cat. He's the best cat in the world, but love kittens. Absolutely love kittens. I also love horses. I grew up loving horses too. So baby horses are another favorite.
Oh, and how on earth do they come out walking?
I know. On those wobbly legs.
I know. They are darling too. Mindy, your empathy for the suffering families in your town drew you into working to resolve toxic threats in your state. And like the mighty women in your book, you were motivated to serve in public office because you wanted to really accomplish something, even while swimming against the tide. Thank you so much for bringing your scientific skills and science research background and your whole self to that work that you do.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here talking to you today. And thank you for hosting such an important radio show with such important topics.